Are from our from the Pacific Northwest chapter, and their presentation is on evaluating the impact of baseball at Japanese American World War II internment camps, an assessment of the game and its portrayal in popular culture. If you again silent, keep your phones on silent and your conversations outside, it will be appreciated. And here are Emily and Anthony.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Gosh, it's a lovely crowd here. Standing room only. We love it. Appreciate you being here. Also, let me, before we get going, I just want to say special thanks to Neil Traven and his folks doing the research committee, research presentations. In my opinion, they're the unsung heroes. So thank you.
So my name's Emily Hawks. I'm in the Pacific Northwest Sabre chapter, and Anthony Salazar, and I guess we should just jump right in.
Yep, let's go. Okay, so, you know, we're just, if you take a look at the screen, we just wanted to at least lay out, you know, what our goals are and sort of give you this methodology and rationale for why we're doing what we're doing. For me, you know, I'm a Latino baseball historian, but, you know, some years ago I came across a gentleman who was a ball player in Japanese American internment camp in Minidoka, and I got to hear his story, and it really struck me. And so that story really stayed with me for a number of years until, you know, I started talking with Emily about this, and turns out she has, you know, a rationale for this as well.
My personal background, I'm half Japanese, and my grandparents were interned in the camps during World War II. So after talking with my grandfather about it, we got to talking about baseball in the camps, and he kind of explained to me how important it was, and you know, it really provided them with an escape. So it kind of sparked my interest. And then after talking with Anthony and finding out that he kind of had an interest too, we decided to collaborate on this research project together.
So a lot of what this presentation is, it's more like this discovery. You know, for me, it's an exploration in a different nuance of baseball history. For Emily, it's about a connection to her heritage as well. So, by no means are we the experts. And here we're paying homage here to the experts. Rob, who you heard earlier, thank you very much for all your work and your hard work in a number of years researching Japanese and Japanese-American baseball. And so you hear as well Kerry Nakagawa, Ralph Pierce, Sam Regalado, Bill Staples, and a variety of those institutions that we've sought research from. So again, we're not the experts. What we're doing is relaying a story, something that we've discovered, and then, you know, paying homage to those that have done, you know, years and years extensive research.
So just to give you a few terms of interest, I'll kind of give a little bit more background on why these are significant, but Issei is basically first-generation Japanese immigrants. Nisei were their children, generally born in the U.S. Sansei is third generation, and Iwa be Yonsei. And then Nikkei is just Japanese-Americans of all generations.
Our story begins.
So first of all, we're just going to kind of give a general overview of the timeline of Japanese-American immigration and kind of the years leading up to the internment. So Japanese-American immigration really started in the late 19th century during the Meiji Restoration in Japan. And this was a time when the Japanese government was moving away from a feudal-type government towards a more imperial government under Emperor Meiji. And as a result, they were really moving away from more of an agricultural focus to a more industrial, urbanized kind of society. And as a result, a lot of these farmers were displaced, so they were looking for opportunities elsewhere, and many of them decided to come to America. So at first, most people tended to go to Hawaii, but the immigration eventually expanded to the west coast of the contiguous U.S. as well. And they were really initially welcomed by a lot of the industrialists, because after the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, they were really lacking for laborers. So initially, Japanese Americans tended to fill the roles of kind of the migrant laborers, so farm workers, they worked in canneries and on the railroads and things like that. But eventually, many of them went on to become business owners or own farms of their own. And as a result of this, they kind of experienced a lot of backlash. So after the Gentlemen's Agreement of 1907, further immigration of Japanese workers was halted, although they were still allowed to bring over their spouses. So that kind of started the era of picture brides, which is actually what my great-grandmothers were. So they basically did their courtship via correspondence and then brought their spouses over that way. But immigration from Japan was effectively ended entirely in 1924 after the Immigration Act that was passed in that year. And as a result of that, that's what really created that distinct separation of generations within the Japanese-American community. And that Immigration Act wasn't overturned for, you know, 40 more years. So, but the other thing of note is the Niseis actually made up 50% of the Japanese-American population by 1930. So there was a significant percentage of the Japanese-American population that was actually born in the U.S., and the Niseis were actually responsible for forming the Japanese-American Citizens League, and you can see their creed here, which is pretty interesting given the backdrop of the times. It says, "I am proud that I am an American citizen of Japanese ancestry, for my very background makes me appreciate more fully the wonderful advantages of this nation. I pledge myself to defend her against all enemies, foreign and domestic."
Things change. December 7, 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor.
And in February of 1942, FDR passed Executive Order 9066, which authorized the exclusion of all persons of Japanese ancestry that were living along the west coast of the United States. There was a lot of, you know, hostility towards them even beforehand, but pretty much as soon as one of these exclusion orders was posted, they were given 1 week to gather only what they could carry and report to an assembly center. And those were usually kind of hastily constructed horse stables while they were waiting for the actual internment camps to be created. And you can see where the actual camps were located here. They were deliberately placed in desolate areas really far from civilization. My grandparents were located in Jerome, Arkansas, Poston, Arizona, and Amache, Colorado. So here you can just see a few images of, first of all, the assembly centers when they're initially reporting for the camps, and then after the camps are constructed, you can see that they're just kind of hastily thrown together tar paper barracks. There were multiple families living together. It was really tight living quarters, you know, not a lot of space, and surrounded by barbed wire and guard towers where the guards' guns were pointed inward rather than outward.
And here we see a great photograph from the acclaimed photographer Ansel Adams, who in 1943, it turns out he was a good friend of the camp director at Manzanar. And so he was allowed to come in and photograph life at the camps. And what he says, when offering the collection to the library in 1965, Adams said in a letter, "The purpose of my work was to show how these people suffered under a great injustice and loss of property. Businesses and profession has overcome the sense of defeat and despair by building for themselves a vital community in an arid but magnificent environment. All in all, I think the Manzanar collection is an important historical document, and I trust it will be put to good use." And when you see some of Ansel Adams' work, the photograph work, there are two things that he couldn't do. So he had some criteria. One, in his photographs, he could not show guard towers. And he could not show the fences. And so he was able to get around that in some of his photographs by photographing the shadows. And our research doesn't necessarily include baseball, but in our research, you see that some of the photographs that he did create, you see the shadows of the barbed wire in the fields. You see the shadows of the guard towers in the areas there. So he was able to get around that. But, you know, he was really struck by the fact that, you know, like he said, these people suffered under inhumane conditions and were, you know, dealing with their civil liberties taken away.
So this is just a photo of the Block 42 baseball team at Minidoka. Minidoka was a camp that was located in Idaho. And these were mostly evacuees that were removed from Washington. And in most cases, the organizers of the leagues within the camps were members of the Nisei leagues, and they pretty much jumped to construction right away. In most cases that we were reading about, these former Nisei league members would kind of rally the troops to get out there and build the camps as soon as they got there and form leagues immediately. And these leagues included as many as 32 teams in most cases and separated into different divisions. So.
And here we've what we're seeing here are a couple of shots of All-Star Games played in 1944, where one of the ironies in World War II, where the teams from various camps were allowed to travel thousands of miles to participate in ball games, and the stipulation was as long as they were wearing their uniforms and not civilian clothes. And so here are these photographs. You see All-Star teams playing at Mount Hart Mountain Baseball Camp in 1944, located in Wyoming.
So one of the interesting things that we found is at pretty much every camp, there was a newspaper published. And these were generally published every week, and they tended to focus on news that was happening within the camps because they didn't really have a lot of access to information that was happening outside of the camps. So a lot of it was things like birth announcements and other goings-on, but there was a huge focus on sports. So there were usually a few pages devoted solely to the sports that were going on in the camps. So here we just pulled from the Manzanar Free Press the weekly schedule for some of the different baseball games that are going on, as well as the standings for what they had were the National League and International League. And you can also see the team names. They were generally organized either around location or profession. So usually locations of where they were originally interned from or the professions that they held before going into the camps. And it even went into as much detail as individual batting statistics. You can see there on the right. And then oftentimes they would kind of tell an actual story of the games that happened. So that's what you see on the left. It's kind of a detailed account of a more interesting game that happened in Minidoka. And on the right, we pulled this out of a newspaper. We just thought it was kind of an interesting quote. It's basically writing about the Issei, which was the first generation Japanese, and their interest in the game. So it says, anytime you can't find your pop, just go out to the baseball field, and one out of two times, you'll find him there. Since evacuation, our old men have been eating and sleeping baseball day and night. Bowl sessions are always going on by boiler rooms, and the main topic always seems to be about baseball. And something very interesting that we found in two of the camp newspapers, Branch Rickey had actually taken out an article. And I just want to read it here. This is the one that was from the Roar Outpost, which was at a camp in Arkansas. So he was writing to the School Health and Physical Education Department. So he says, "Dear Mr. Holland, we will be most happy to have any boys that you might recommend in our baseball camp this summer. And if any of these boys have sufficient ability to play professional baseball, we will, of course, recommend them just as we would any other young man. The fact that these boys are American boys is good enough for the Brooklyn Club. Whether they are of Japanese, English, or of Polish ancestry makes no difference to us, and I know that those boys would be treated with the greatest courtesy and respect. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that the camps which we'll run this summer will not be too close to McGehee, Arkansas, or our nearest camp may be in Oklahoma, somewhere around the latter part of August. We will hold camps in Des Moines, etc. There may be a possibility that later in the summer we may conduct a camp at Little Rock. At any rate, if any of the boys are able to attend any of these camps, we would be most happy to have them. Very truly yours, Branch Rickey Jr." And it was just really interesting to us because this is, you know, 4 years before Jackie Robinson actually broke in with the Dodgers. So.
And here we see a map of Minidoka. The blue circles you see there represent the ball fields. So there are four ball fields at Minidoka where they were allowed to play. So, and here's where we come to the story of my neighbor Hank. This is Hank Masubu. I met him a few years ago. He was about around 80 or so. And this is a little bit of his story. So Hank was, you know, a kid growing up in Corbett, Oregon. He played ball in high school at Corbett High School before the war. And during the war with his family, he was forced into internment camp at Minidoka. And you know, he talks about, in my interview with him, he talks about being part of the kids playing baseball as well. And you know, typically the story is that you find some other guys that are looking to play, and you just start playing ball, and just as a way to relieve the boredom, and it was something to do. So following the war, Hank spends 19 months in the Army in Special Services at Fort Lewis, and playing ball there for the baseball team, winning the 6th Army Championship. He was good enough to get a scholarship to the College of Idaho, where he batted 300, and his team won the 1948 Pacific Northwest Conference with a record of 21-6. He was good enough to get scouted by Japanese teams in Kobe, Tokyo, and Hiroshima, and was also scouted by the Pirates and by the Red Sox. He signed with the Pittsburgh Pirates for $3,000. He was originally offered $2,000, but when he told the Pirates that the Red Sox were also interested, they upped the ante to $3,000, so he was able to get another $1,000 bonus. He was assigned to the Reds of the California Baseball League, and in 1949, Hank played 55 games, as you see, batting .236. He had, soon after that season, his father took ill. And so he had received a letter saying, hey, you need to come back home and help work the family farm. So he left baseball, regrettably, and dutifully went back to his family to help work the farm. He later married his wife, Edna, in 1952. They moved to Seattle, where they, for a number of decades, operated a successful grocery store. And next slide here, oops. Next slide here, you see that he was... indicated here, playing for the Reds there, and the caption, as you see, reads that with his teammate there, that he's believed to be the first Japanese battery in pro ball, making their debut for the team for the Modesto Reds, playing in Bakersfield that Sunday. And so this was taken Thursday, July 7, 1949. And here you see in 2007, the Seattle Mariners had a salute to Japanese-American baseball, and you see Hank and a couple of his teammates meeting Ichiro Suzuki. Yeah.
So now we're just going to touch on how this story actually appears in popular culture, and we found actually some interesting books and a movie as well that we read and watched. So the first one is actually over here, children's book called Baseball Saved Us, and then there's also the Journal of Ben Uchida. And there were also a couple more released more recently in 2012. And all of these kind of center on the same themes. In general, these are Nisei boys that kind of fell in love with the game as a result of their parents sharing their love for the game as well. A common theme is kind of using baseball not only as an escape, but also as a way to demonstrate their Americanism. Rather than kind of revolting against American ideals, they actually gravitated more towards the American ideals to demonstrate their loyalty to the country, and baseball was an outlet for them to do that.
In 2007, a movie came out from Warner Brothers called American Pastime, and what it really portrays is the Japanese-American story in internment camps during World War II. In typical Hollywood format, you've got your conflict, you've got your figured out how the solution is, and of course you get your love story. And what you see here, they're in Topaz, Utah. They actually went out to near the actual campsite with a budget of $3 million and had a blueprint of Topaz and actually built it from the ground up. So the stories that you see here, or the photographs that you see here, really just illustrate in Hollywood format what the plight was like. They actually had Cary Nakagawa, who was served as one of the producers and experts on the ground there, helping to see the movie through its course. And what you also note that in 2007, following the movie's release, you see a group led by Cary Nakagawa and others go around to different parts of the country to Japanese American communities to tell this story. And so I think part of that, you saw that slide earlier where the Mariners are doing this salute to Japanese American baseball, also in 2007, really helping to tell that story. see a few more of these stills from the movie. And also, what you notice, the character in the bottom right, you see behind him the American flag. When in our research and looking at some of the popular culture plights of kids in particular, you see that image played out a number of times where the American flag's in the back, and it's this feeling that you must be American to play baseball.
So now we're just going to touch on some of the baseball in art that we found in the Japanese American internment camps. So these were actually pulled from one of those children's books, I believe. And again, you know, just kind of featuring prominently are the barbed wire, the guard towers, things like that. But again, the kind of flags and different kinds of Americana that appear as well. So.
And here we found some really great artwork by this one of the internees, Estella Shigo. You know, based on what we found at the Japanese American Museum, this is indicated that she's done this work in pencil and paper around somewhere between 1942 and 1945. What you see is that she's starting to develop a little bit of her craft. You know, you see some of the simple lines. Well, let's jump over and we see this was done in 1943, where her artwork actually does become a little bit more defined. You see, you know, a lot of things going on here. The kids on the bench, you see the ball, the fly ball out there, and the outfielder chasing down the ball. Here again, done in pencil and paper. And something else we found at UCLA, you know, this is Estelle. Now it's called a baseball game, and it's actually called done in the summer of 1943. Her craft is becoming much more refined. And here, what's different? You see that girls playing baseball, girls playing ball, and that's really a different shift that we didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. So we looked into that a little bit more and found that actually women very often played baseball and softball in the camps, and they often had just as many fields as the men did. Apart from that, some of the older Issei women were really involved in making sure that they had the right equipment to play, the right uniforms, and they would repurpose anything they could find to actually make uniforms for these players. So oftentimes that might be using an old, you know, potato sack or rice sack and trying to make a uniform out of it.
And this, you know, going back to the same map, this shows, you know, the four ball fields where, you know, as we mentioned, the men played, but also where the women were allowed to play as well.
I guess there was one other anecdote about the women that we wanted to share. We found an article that was pretty funny in one of the old newspapers that was talking about a sort of all-star game between the men and the women that had been played in one of the camps, and the women were leading until the eighth inning, and then all of a sudden men came back, and they found out that they had been cheating, so it was this big scandal within the camps, and it was written up, so that was a pretty funny story.
And here we just wanted to at least give you a record about, you know, we're talking about 120,000 Japanese Americans who are put into incarceration in various parts around the country, even though 75% were U.S. citizens. And so there you see the breakdown of where folks were put and, you know, how long their stay lasted. So at this point, we're done. We really thank you very much for your consideration. And if you have any questions.
Any questions?
Yeah, I was kind of interested in your source documents. I'd be a little surprised if there was any really formal archives, given the, I would think the government would like to forget this chapter of their history. So, you know, some of those things, the newspaper articles, the in-camp newspapers, were those saved by families and
no, those are actually pretty easy to come by. There are pretty extensive journals, academic journals, where you can go back and find pretty much every newspaper that there was in just about every camp.
Okay, just a couple more questions.
I just wanted to know, in your research, you put up that letter from Brands Rickey, and he said, well, we don't have any camps right now, but we will be coming near you soon. Do you know if anybody actually showed up when they came, or if they were allowed to somehow leave?
Yeah, there
leave,
were
or?
At least two players, and I don't remember their names off the top of my head, and they actually were able to go to one of the, I think, Little Rock tryouts, but neither of them made it.
The really cool thing about that is just how right on Branch Rickey was in 1943, 4 years before Jackie Robinson.
One quick question. Did they ever play the guards in the camps?
Like in the movie. You know what? And that's funny because, you know, in this particular movie, American Pastime, they're playing the town team. But we've not come across anything where they were actually playing the guards, you know, themselves, like in another Hollywood type of sports movie. Like Victory, I think, is one that comes to mind.
One more? Oh, my goodness. All right. So sorry. I'm sure they'll be able to stick around outside afterwards and take any more questions.
Just real quickly, it seems like there was a concerted effort by the government to allow this freedom to have them travel from camp to camp and to have fields built. Was there any type of a green light letter or any type of like concerted effort by the captors to say, you know what, let's give these people this freedom? Because it looks like, from what we hear, there was no freedoms whatsoever. They seem like they had a lot of freedom here. Was there a concerted effort to let this happen?
I think it was something that just happened over time. You know, at first, you know, it was pretty strict, but then as time went on, and I think that they were pretty obvious, you know, there were no documented cases of espionage, and so most of these petitions went through the actual boards of the camps to approve their travel and things like that, and I think it just got more lenient over time.
All right.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.